Welcome to the Manhattan Institute Point of Law podcast. This is Marie Griffin, Senior Fellow with the Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy. And today I'm talking to Professor John Hasnett of the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University. He recently published a book entitled Trapped: When Acting Ethically is Against the Law, in which he probes important questions about the increasing federalization of crime and its effect on people who are doing business. Welcome, Professor Hasnett.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. Listen, I wanted to ask you first about a little background on the federalization of white-collar crime. You talk in your book about how crime was traditionally overwhelmingly something that was handled at the state and local level, but not so much anymore. Is that correct?
That's correct. Additionally, crime is a state-level offense, and the kind of crime that most people think about, the crime that they see on TV shows like Law and Order, which is murder, theft, arson, crimes of violence, are state-level crimes. The federal government wasn't involved in that for the first 100 years of the country's existence because there was basically no need for them to be involved. State-level police and local police handle those kind of matters. That's still true today, which explains why the Law and Order show is a New York prosecutor and not a federal prosecutor. That kind of crime is state-level crime.
So federal crime is a relatively new phenomenon. Can you help us to better understand what it is that drove the federalization of crime in the political process?
Yeah, I'd say it's a relatively new phenomenon. You can say that federal crime is a feature of the last 100 years or so. There's actually, I'll just make a distinction, there's two types of federal crime. One is the traditional crime of violence that crosses state borders. So if you've got murderers fleeing across state borders, then federal police action may be implicated because there is the jurisdictional issue. That's usually not what we refer to when we're talking about white-collar crime. Maybe the reason why we use the term white-collar crime is to distinguish the part of federal criminal law that addresses business crime from the part of federal criminal law that addresses the traditional crimes that transcend state borders. White-collar crime is used to refer to the kind of crime that's associated with business. This probably dates back to the late 19th century, where the mail fraud statute was passed. And that was a statute originally designed to prevent fraudulent use of the mails. That's evolved into a vast array of federal fraud offenses. I'll say this about federal white-collar crime. Because traditional crimes of violence and even crimes of fraud were dealt with at the state level, the federal criminal code will not mirror the same offenses as the state criminal code. Federal fraud will be something different. And as a matter of fact, it's something broader and less well-defined than traditional state-level fraud.
You know, in terms of this very broad federal criminal law of fraud, I was hoping that you could specifically discuss mail and wire fraud, federal mail and wire fraud. My understanding is that the United States Supreme Court has granted certiorari in a case that they will decide this coming year, which could potentially impose some limitations on what appears to be a nearly limitless federal statute. Could you let us know a little bit more about that?
Fraud, traditionally, as a crime at state level, would be the crime of false pretenses, which required a misrepresentation of a material fact that someone else relied on and suffered a loss of property. Well, federal fraud is much, much broader than that. To commit a federal offense, one need only be involved in a scheme or artifice to defraud, which means it doesn't have to be a fraud, it's just an attempt to fraud. No one needs to rely on any representation. It doesn't have to be a misrepresentation of fact. It can simply be non-disclosure. It doesn't have to be a loss of property. The way the statute is defined, you can commit a fraud when you deprive someone of his or her intangible right to your honest services. So it becomes a very, very, very broad offense. That's an inchoate offense since it doesn't have to be complete. Now, a few years ago, the Second Circuit, in a case called Rebicki, did say essentially that federal fraud offenses are virtually limitless in scope. Almost any dishonest practice engaged in business could be a federal fraud. Now, there's a lot of a lot of discrepancies among the circuits as to how you define this because it's so broad. So it's not surprising that the Supreme Court may soon rule and try to clear this up a bit. Hopefully they'll restrict the scope of federal fraud somewhat, but even with a restriction placed on it, it's still a very, very broad offense. Almost any kind of dishonest conduct can bring you within the scope of a federal prosecutor's sight.
Justice Scalia in the past has warned that the expansive interpretations of the federal mail and wire fraud laws, quote, invite abuse by headline-seeking prosecutors in pursuit of local officials and others to engage in any manner of unappealing or ethically questionable conduct. My question for you is that a serious issue? Do we need to worry about politically driven prosecutions under these statutes? Is that the correct locus of concern?
Well, yes, it's a concern, and we do have to be worried about that. I'm very much opposed to this type of broad criminal legislation. On the other hand, I'm sympathetic to the prosecutors. I can try to explain why. The federal prosecutor's job is to enforce the law the way the Congress writes it. The Congress writes an extremely broad statute that applies to all the businesses in the United States. It's extremely difficult for prosecutors to enforce it by the traditional methods of prosecution. I mean, within the limits of giving everyone a presumption of innocence, proving cases beyond a reasonable doubt, it's a daunting task. And it's natural for prosecutors who have limited budgets to be looking to save resources in any way they can. So to some extent, prosecutors are put in a situation where they have to look for ways around the traditional criminal safeguard. Does the broadness of the statutes mean that there's a risk of prosecutors trying to grab headlines? Yeah, it's possible. You have to keep in mind that almost all federal prosecutors are extremely sincere, hardworking people who don't do that. The risk is that there are some that aren't. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Elliot Spitzer, although he wasn't federal, but as a state-level prosecutor, he pretty much was a good example of someone who was out for headlines and was using prosecutions, in my opinion, to advance his political career. So it's a possibility, and it's a danger, but it's a result of the breadth of the statute much more than any ill will on the part of the prosecutors that should really give us pause.
I'd like to ask you a question about corporate criminal liability, which you discuss at some length in your book. Most people, especially non-lawyers, usually think of the criminal law as being an instrument that's used to enforce social norms against individuals who have done something blameworthy. And yet now we have this phenomenon where we are criminally prosecuting corporations themselves, entities comprised of, you know, many cooperating individuals. And of course, we can't impose certain traditional criminal penalties, such as imprisonment, on a corporation. Can you give us some insight into why there's been such a growth in corporate criminal liability? And let us know what drawbacks, if any, you think are associated with this phenomenon.
Yeah, I can certainly talk to you about why there's been such a growth. But in identifying corporate criminal responsibility, you've come to the very heart of the problem. As I said a moment ago, prosecutors almost can't enforce the broad and other statutes that Congress has passed on the public under the normal constraints of the criminal law. Corporate criminal responsibility actually is what they need to enforce these provisions. Corporate criminal responsibility means you can put a corporation on trial for the offenses of the individual employee. Right? A corporation doesn't have a body. A corporation doesn't have a brain. A corporation is a collection of individuals. It doesn't really act by itself. What can it possibly mean to hold a corporation criminally responsible? Well, the law defines corporate criminal responsibility as the responsibility for the offenses of any employee acting within the scope of his or her employment for the benefit of the corporation. So what happens is individual offenses get attributed to the corporate entity. A corporation can't be imprisoned. It can only be fined. There's your first problem, because to fine a corporation is to impose a financial penalty, and financial penalty is borne by the shareholders. They're the owners of the corporation. But the definition of the modern corporation is one in which there's a separation of ownership and control. So shareholders may own the corporation. They don't control the actions of the employees. So in a sense, any time you punish a corporation for the actions of its employees, you're punishing people who are innocent, the shareholders, for the actions of others who are guilty. Now, the people who commit offenses, they're already subject to criminal punishment as individuals, so they could be punished. Corporate criminal responsibility really adds no punishment to those who are guilty. It just poses the risk that will impose fines on those who are innocent. So what's the purpose of it? Well, the purpose is that it's very difficult to get convictions of individuals who commit dishonest conduct in a business setting. You would have to get sufficient evidence to make your case beyond a reasonable doubt. Much of the evidence would be in the hands of the defendant or the corporation. The privilege against self-incrimination and the attorney-client privilege prevents the government from getting its hands on the kind of information it needs. So there are major impediments to getting conviction. That's the way our system is set up. Our system is designed to protect defendants. It's designed to make it difficult for the government to take away the liberty of its citizens. So it's intentionally prejudiced toward defendants, and this causes great difficulty in getting convictions. All right. Corporate criminal responsibility is just a key that opens the door for prosecutors. Why? Because by threatening to prosecute a corporation, the prosecutors can get the corporation to provide the evidence they need to go after the individual employees.
In your 2006 Cato Institute published book, Trapped, you talked a lot about the moral dilemmas that a senior executive or board member of a corporation might face if the corporation itself is being threatened with a criminal prosecution. And that's deeply related, isn't it, to prosecutors putting pressure on corporations in order to gain access to these kinds of privileged documents. So I'm hoping that you can explain to us how that works.
This is the mechanism that prosecutors can use to put pressure on individuals. A corporation can't really bear an indictment. As we saw with Arthur Andersen, on indictment, the corporation disappears. And if you're an executive running a corporation, you've got an obligation to the shareholders to protect the corporation's interests. That's one of your ethical obligations. Now, you also have ethical obligations to your employees. You've got an obligation to keep your word to them. If you promise confidentiality, you must provide it. You've got some obligation to treat them fairly, to treat them with what would be called procedural or organizational justice. But corporate criminal responsibility allows the prosecutor to place corporate executives in what can be fairly called a dilemma, because the only way to protect the corporation's well-being and thereby protect the interests of the owners and the shareholders is to do what's required to avoid an indictment. Indictment can mean death if you're dependent on your reputation or if you're dependent on government contracts. And what's the only way to avoid an indictment? Well, under the present system, the only way is to have what's called an effective compliance program and to cooperate with federal criminal investigation. And cooperation is defined by the Department of Justice in one of its memorandum, now called the Philip Memorandum, as requiring three things. The first is acceptance of responsibility. The second is disclosure of all pertinent information. And the third is the refusal to support culpable employees. Well, if you have to start by accepting responsibility, you must begin by saying the corporation has done something wrong. And since corporations act only through the employees, to cooperate, the first thing you have to do is say that your employees have done something wrong. That makes them culpable employees. Now you can't shield them, because that would be a failure of cooperation. Plus, you must turn over all pertinent information about what they've done to the government. So in a sense, the corporation, in order to protect itself, must become a deputy prosecutorial agent. It's got to work to help the Department of Justice make its case against individuals. And this places the corporation itself and the executives in control of it in an adversarial relationship to the corporation's employees. It is a dilemma, because let's say there's a promise to employees to not have any adverse consequences unless they've been shown to have done something wrong after a fair hearing. Well, if the first thing you have to do to cooperate is to accept responsibility, you really don't have time to wait for the outcome of a fair hearing. You have to pretty much declare your employees guilty right off the bat. So there's a presumption of guilt. And the ability of the Federal Department of Justice to threaten corporate criminal responsibility places the ethical business person in the following situation. He or she is torn between the steps that will most effectively protect the corporation that he or she's got the responsibility to run and the things that would be fair treatment to the employees or would involve honoring commitments made previously to employees, such as to maintain confidentiality of communications.
A quick follow-up to that. Is the problem here just that corporations are making promises to employees that they're in no position to keep? Should they be promising that any communications are confidential or that they'll act in the employee's interest in the case of a conflict? Can this be solved with a disclosure form or a waiver, the right kind of language parties, or is there a real cost, even if everyone's on the same page in terms of expectations?
There's no simple, direct solution to this. It's truly a dilemma in the following sense. There's no easy way out if you maintain corporate criminal responsibility. Here's why. Corporation can say, listen, we'd like you to give us information about unethical or illegal behavior. We want you to come forward and communicate your concerns to us. But we can promise confidentiality only to a limited extent, and if anything you say should indicate any kind of criminal activity, we'll share it with federal prosecutors. If you make that kind of representation above board, so that every employee understands the nature of the promise, very little information will come forward, because nobody wants to run the risk. On the other hand, the way the promise is made now is often corporations will say there's a confidential employee hotline and we'll keep this secret. Or they might ask employees to speak to corporate counsel under the protection of attorney-client privilege. Now, to be honest, they can't say that these things are perfectly confidential. Corporate counsel usually has to give something that they refer to as the Upjohn warning, which sounds like this. You can confide in us and all communications will be kept confidential. Under the scope of attorney-client privilege, please keep in mind that the corporation is our client, and then warning goes on. Most employees don't know the phrase, the corporation is our client, means that the privilege will be waived whenever it's good for the corporation, even if it means sacrificing the interest of the employee and breaking confidentiality. So your choice is to make an honest promise, then get no useful information, or make a deceptive promise, and then in a sense, be tricking your employees into waiving their privileges. As this becomes more and more known, information is drying up anyway, because the more astute employees now know whenever there's a criminal investigation, they've got to get their own lawyer, and they cannot rely on corporate counsel. So in the long term, this policy will be self-defeating, but today there's still many, many cases in which employees think that the company is going to have some loyalty to them and protect their interests. And the company simply can't afford to do that when threatened with indictment. So the expression used by corporate counsel or by criminal defense attorneys for the attitude the corporate body has to take towards the employees is something like this: when it comes time to protect the corporate interest, we have to throw the employees under the bus. And that's a pretty good metaphor for employees' situation under this particular state of the law. Right? There's no easy way out. There's a theoretically simple solution, and that's simply to not allow corporations to be prosecuted in the first place. If there's no corporate criminal responsibility, prosecutors have to go after the individuals. The corporations and corporate executives can give their employees fair hearings. Most corporations will cooperate anyway because they don't want true criminals as part of their organization. But the kind of pressure we're talking about now comes from and probably can only be relieved by getting rid of corporate criminal responsibility and the ability to indict a corporation rather than the individual to actually commit the offense.
Well, this is obviously a very politically aggressive remedy, eliminating corporate criminal responsibility in favor of holding only individual criminal defendants responsible. on one hand, it's very intuitively appealing to people like me who feel that the criminal law is only appropriate to use in response to genuinely blameworthy antisocial behavior, not to mere regulatory violations, for example. On the other hand, one might object, well, if we eliminate corporate criminal responsibility, there are various types of corporate behavior which will be harmful to society in the aggregate that we want to police and we won't be able to police. How would you respond to that kind of objection?
That it's wrong. If we get rid of corporate criminal responsibility, there is no offense that's not prosecutable. You simply have to prosecute the individuals who've committed the offense. You have to go after the individuals and not the corporate entity. This is true. If you can't use the tactics that we've been talking about, which coerce corporations into becoming deputy prosecutorial agents, it becomes more difficult for prosecutors to get to successful convictions. In order to convict individuals, they've got to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. They've got to get enough evidence. They've got to meet all of the traditional requirements of criminal law. Prosecutors, whether it's in traditional crime or federal crime, have tough jobs because they have to meet a lot of benchmarks before they can take away an individual's liberty. But that's the nature of their job. That's not going to be an excuse for cutting corners. It should be hard for them to get convictions under that case. So it may be that the conviction rate or the guilty plea rate will go way down if there's no corporate criminal responsibility. It's not true that there's any crimes that can't be prosecuted or that can't that will go unpunished, because for there to be a crime, there has to be somebody doing something wrong in the first place. And that person's always subject to conviction if the prosecutors can make the case.
Professor Hasnes, thank you so very much for talking to us today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, Hannah, are we done?